You're listening to the Ministry Grow Show, brought to you by Reliant Creative, the creative agency for gospel-centered ministries. Find out more at reliantcreative.org.
Welcome to the Ministry Grow Show, a podcast dedicated to helping churches and ministries grow and make more effective impacts for the kingdom of God in an ever-changing digital world. Whether you're building and growing a gospel-centered ministry or leading a church, if you want insight into the strategies, struggles, challenges, and successes of other ministry leaders, you've come to the right place.
Welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. Today on the show, we're going to be talking with Holland Frazier. She's the president of All God's Children International. Holland, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Zach, for having me.
I'm excited to get into it with you and hear a little bit about your ministry. Can you, to kick us off and give us some context for the conversation today, just tell us about All God's Children and what's the origin story? How'd you guys get started? What do you guys do? Those kind of things.
Yeah. So All God's Children was actually founded 32 years ago when my older sister at the age of 18 left Bible college in Europe and traveled into war-torn Romania and did the adoption of my youngest sister for my parents. And back in 1991, coming off the airplane at the Portland International Airport, news media was there because Hannah was one of the first kids coming out of Eastern Europe through adoption. And she made this statement that she would help anyone that wanted to help a child. And the next day, my parents' phones started just ringing off the hook. And within that month, All God's Children was founded.
That's crazy.
Well, the crazy, yeah, it was a crazy story when you think of 18 years old, 32 years ago. There was no cell phones and location trackers.
Well, just to kick off a ministry like that is wild.
Yeah. And I, you know, when she first said, "Hey, I'm going to Romania to volunteer in orphanage number one," my parents said, "Absolutely not. You are not going to Romania." And she was like, "I'm in Europe and I'm 18 and I'm going." But it was when she came back from that trip that they saw photos of the kids that she was serving, that God started to put on their heart that they wanted to open our home to another child. And so she ended up going back that winter and ended up doing the adoption of Hannah for my parents.
Okay. That's interesting. So did your parents help her start the organization? Like how did the birthing of the organization come out of that story?
So it was all three of them that founded and started the organization. So she ended up going back to Romania within 2 months of Hannah's adoption and helping other families complete adoptions of kids that were living in institutions there.
Very cool.
And really, like over the last 32 years, we have unified over 4,000 families through adoption from 28 countries worldwide.
Okay. So you're working in collaboration with orphanages to connect kids and children to families that want to adopt.
It started out that way back in like the early 90s, but over the last three decades, international adoption has changed dramatically. Yeah. So in 2012, the Hague Convention came into play, which allowed a lot more government oversight to inter-country adoption, which was something that was needed due to just a lot of the corruption that was happening and taking place. And so today what that looks like is we actually partner with other governments to really place children that are the most vulnerable. They're usually over the age of seven, large sibling groups, or kids with significant special needs. So it's definitely evolved over the last three decades as we've seen just that landscape of adoption really change pretty dramatically from about 2012 to today. We've gone from 24,000 children being adopted a year into the U.S. to under 1,100. So definitely more difficult today. The kids are there. It's just a matter of like the process is really layered.
And this is specifically international adoption that we're talking about has seen those drastic numbers decline?
Yes, in-country adoption.
So you would say the Hague intervention was a good thing, but it had some negative consequences.
Absolutely.
Like overall, it was helpful because you've heard all the story. I've heard a lot of stories of adoption just going terribly wrong and being used for evil purposes. So this intervention was good, but ultimately resulted in less kids getting adopted into healthy, safe environments.
True. As well as, you just had different factors. I mean, some political situations like Russia mm-hmm. closed their country for inter-country adoption years back, but more of a political mm-hmm. purpose. China has not reopened post-COVID. Okay. So, and families are still waiting and praying that they can bring their kids home that they were matched with. So you just see a lot of different reasons that make it cumbersome and those numbers so drastically lower, as well as it's the needs of kids. You know, a lot of families back 30 years ago were wanting to adopt babies, children under two, and that's not the need that exists today. Today, really organizations, ministries that are working in inter-country adoption know the needs of kids are older, large sibling groups with really complex trauma and needs. And so that family is a very specific family being called into bringing those mm-hmm. kids home.
Yeah. So as that shift took place with the Hague, am I pronouncing that right? Hague or Hage?
The Hague Convention.
How did that change how you guys functioned as a ministry? So it sounded like you went from a lot of adoption to now there's a bigger support in orphanage and orphan care within the orphanages that exist. What has that done to change how you function as a ministry?
Yeah, I would say really back in that time period of like 2012 to 2017, you know, I think of the Israelites just, in the desert for years, and you're just going, okay, God, I know that you're there and I know you have a reason and a purpose. But we were like, up until that point, the ministry was funded 90% through adoption service fees. And only 10% was really donor revenue. And so when that bottom fell out of inter-country adoption, you saw hundreds of adoption agencies not even make it. I mean, they just closed. So for us, it really is a God story of just how it was kind of the manna from heaven. I don't even know some of those years how we transitioned. But what I do know very clearly is that not only did God provide, but He gave us a vision of what was to come. And when we looked around and saw, yes, inter-country adoption isn't necessarily going to be how we serve these kids. These kids are still mm-hmm. there. Today, there are millions of children languishing in institutions globally without a voice, without anyone knowing their name. And so for us, it was, we need to start working on that continuum mm-hmm. of care. We need to, number one, preserve families. Children should never fall out of family care. God did not intend for children to be alone. They belong in family. And so we do a lot of ministry with families on the brink of dissolving. And then we step into institutions, which we know many, many, many institutions globally are pretty desperate places. Mm-hmm. You can just walk into them and feel the spirit of just despair and hopelessness. And so we step into those places and really work to disrupt trauma and bring healing to caregivers and children and create really home environments in these places where we are serving not only the children, but the caregivers mm-hmm. and the leaders. And we work to place children back into family, first and foremost, or into an adoptive family, whether that be through foster care, domestic adoption, and then lastly, inter-country adoption. And then for the vast number of kids that are aging out of these systems, we have programs and services to meet their needs where they can actually break that cycle and create a path to independence. So the vision and mission really of how that's evolved today is we empower local leaders to create, really to disrupt trauma and create the pathway to safe family and independence for the children we serve.
And so where's the bulk of your work taking place? Is it international or domestic? It sounds like you're coming alongside domestically in the foster system. Are you a majority of the work that you do is by percentage done internationally, or has that kind of evened out over the course of these shifts and changes in the ministry?
No, we're primarily almost 100% international. Okay. So we work in 14 countries today, and we have two child advocacy centers. One is in Colombia, Bogota, Colombia. The other is in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And we will launch our third child advocacy center in a town close to Manila in the Philippines. Okay. And so those are really our hubs of where and how we empower local leaders to work on that continuum of care for kids in advocating for children and disrupting trauma. Because what I think our learning has been as we've evolved and as we've really just sought the Lord and like, how do you want us to meet these unmet needs? Because we've really, it is, yes, the continuum of care, but what sits at the root of that is generational trauma. You know, there's this saying of hurt people hurt people, but healed people can empower people to heal. And when you just kind of look at that life of Jesus, you know, anytime there was a need, he went, and he always had movement in how he served others. And we really are looking, you know, today the science, the neuroscience has all these like new findings of, oh, trauma is passed down. I think science today says, you know, four generations, but we know from the Bible, it's passed down for seven or more. Like, so it's not new when you look at it from a spiritual aspect. But for us, when we're looking at how do we empty institutions and bring wholeness to families, the root of that is generational sin, generational trauma, and how do we bring healing to the healing of Jesus to hurt people? Because that's how you end the orphan crisis.
Yeah, that's a good transition. Can you kind of dive a little bit further into your trauma disruption work and explain what all that involves and what's included in that? Because that's honestly, it's been a bit of a trend in the show, just in conversation coming up with recent ministries that have been featured on the show. That idea, that topic continues to come up. And so it's been a really fascinating learning experience for me. So I'd be interested to hear how you guys are approaching that and what learnings you're having and experiencing, especially in an international context with the children you're working with. I mean, our own adoption and orphanage and foster care systems are broken institutions. My wife and I are in the process of the foster process. And so we see the brokenness in that system, but it's, I know from traveling and seeing the different parts of the rest of the world, it's far worse than it is here. And so how do you step into those really broken institutions, and what are the things that you are learning on the ground in those really hard places around trauma, disruption work and care that maybe other ministry leaders can glean insights from?
Well, I'd start by saying, you know, we know that trauma affects a person's behavior, their brain, their body, their belief system and biology. A lot of times, especially in child welfare systems globally, and here, people look at kids' behavior. Mm-hmm. And that's about, you know, bad kid, good kid. And they're not looking at, like, we say it's like the iceberg, right? The tip of the iceberg is all above the water. Well, that's behavior. And that is true for both adults and children. And so for us, one of the pieces to that is we know hurt people hurt people. Many times in these systems, we look at those adults who've harmed kids, and we just look at them, you know, kind of lock them up and remove kids, and they go into these systems. But truly, those adults were just probably kids who were harmed mm-hmm. as well. So how do we come in and bring that healing to caregivers, leaders, parents, and the children themselves so that there can be restoration? And we know that individuals are hurt through relationship. So healing has to come through relationship, mm-hmm. which is the example of Jesus. So when you look at Jesus, he always led every interaction through connection. And then he empowered us with his Holy Spirit and then taught correction. And so we have, we utilize actually a tool in partnership with the Karen Purvis Institute for Child okay. Development. They have a tool called Trust-Based Relational Intervention. And we are one of the institutes, really like one of their only global ambassadors.
Oh, interesting.
That take that tool. And we are actually applying that not only within institutions globally, but within the system itself in training leaders that are connected to these systems, that are creating policies, making decisions on behalf of these kids. And then we're working directly with at-risk families. So as well as our adoptive families. So we kind of take that neuroscience evidence-based approach, and we're applying that on the ground within the continuum of care of kids.
That's cool. Yeah, Karen Purvis comes up often in foster education. Like I've become familiar with her just through going through this process. So that's interesting that you guys are one of the only organizations that is applying these tools within an international context. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm honored. I sit on their advisory board at the Karen Purvis okay. Institute, and being able to, we're doing a lot of kind of piloting like programs that we're tracking the data within our program. So we have in Ethiopia, a reunification home for girls that are coming off the streets. And in Colombia, we're working with government-run institutions in looking at how do we bring this empowering program of care through these principles all the way down to a child level. And it's just been incredible to see the trauma symptoms decrease as our team is in there and working day in and day out with the caregivers, with the children, with mm-hmm. the leaders. Because it's not, I will say, Zach, like, you know, there's a lot of trauma is a buzzword, and there's a lot of trainings, and you can go online and do A, B, and C. But at the end of the day, where we saw the unmet need, which is what we're always asking ourselves, where is the unmet need? It's not the access to the information because it's out there, but there's no one actually modeling it in a discipleship way on how. And so when we say we're empowering local leaders, we are coming in and giving them those tools on the how. And then watching that expand. And that, I'm telling you, I've been with AGCI 27 years, and I have never seen the Lord move like he has moved in the last 7 years through AGCI. Like just the highest level leaders, presidents, first ladies, like governments coming in and allowing us to come in and do really a wide scale reach and trainings that are changing the actual culture of care for kids, which is only the Lord that can do that type of movement and work. So we really, you know, today we say, you know, how we've really evolved is we're trauma disruptors mm-hmm. that are advocating for kids. And we're not the Americans coming into a country and saying, we have all the answers. It's different. Every culture is different. And we really are about how do we find those leaders on the ground in the country? How do we empower them so that they can go and, you know, have that reach? But truly, it's discipleship at like its core level.
So you found that a lot of these organizations and governments have been receptive to you guys coming in with this training.
Oh, very much so. Like in Colombia 6 years ago, what was intended to be a training for just 300 social workers in partnership with the Care and Purpose Institute, I ended up being in the country 2 weeks before that training. I wasn't supposed to be at the training. And ended up with this just rare chance meeting with the Procuraduría de General of the whole country, who the Procuraduría in that country is like our attorney general. So they're over the judicial side of the government, where child welfare is kind of a separate side. So I had this meeting with him and just was able to share the importance of bringing some of the judges into this training, because it's the judges that are making the decisions and working with the parents. And that if we don't work to really offer tools for healing for parents, we're really doing nothing over here with the kids, because a lot of those kids are going back to these families. And at the end of that meeting, he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to send some judges to that training. I'm going to host the training here at the Procuraduría's office, and I'm going to stream it to every single office in the country. And said, if you'll come back and meet with our team, I want to talk through what those next steps could look like. And 2 weeks later, I went back. We trained 1,400 leaders in Colombia. Supreme Court justices opened the conference. And 2 years ago, two or three, it was no COVID, 2020. So 4 years ago, because of that training we did, we were able after that to bring 17 leaders to the States to become practitioner trained through the Care and Purpose Institute. We have now hired some of those leaders, and we are now doing the practitioner training in Latin America, in Spanish, in a cultural context, and we have reached 17 countries in South America that travel to Colombia to do that practitioner training. So that's kind of some of the movement we're seeing when we say, no, we want to go to, you know, yes, that's government, that's the system that we want to disrupt and bring. And then it kind of funnels all the way down to family, parents and caregivers and children, and engaging churches, the local church, on how they can step in and meet these unmet needs for kids and what that actually looks like. Because it's not easy work.
So it's funneling down through national and local leaders. So it's contextually relevant to where you're at. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, Holland, this has already been fascinating. I want to get into this a little bit further, but I want to make sure we take a moment to hear from today's sponsor. But when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Holland Frazier of All God's Children International.
Are you looking to grow your ministry but don't have the money or marketing knowledge to make that happen? There's good news. Google offers an advertising grant to churches and ministries that is worth $10,000 per month. This means that if your ministry is a 501c3 nonprofit, you are eligible to receive $120,000 per year in free advertising dollars. This allows you to place ads at the top of Google search results pages and drive thousands of visitors to your ministry website every month. Our sponsor, Click Nonprofit, helps your ministry acquire this Google ad grant and manages your Google ads to ensure you get the most out of the grant. Schedule a free consultation at clicknonprofit.com to learn more about how this grant can help your specific ministry. Mention the Ministry Growth Show when you sign up to get 20% off your first 3 months of management.
All right, welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. We've been talking with Holland Frazier of All God's Children International. Holland, as we get back into the conversation, can you share maybe a specific story or case where All God's Children and your approach to trauma-informed care significantly impacted a child's adoption process or just a child's life?
Well, one that comes to mind is in Ethiopia. So we do have a home there, actually in partnership with the Tim Tebow Foundation. Okay. It cares for 24 young women. Girls, actually, I should say, between anywhere from the ages of 5 to 18 that are at risk of being trafficked, but come really off the streets. And One story of one of the individuals that comes to my mind was a 10-year-old little girl named Sebantu. And I'll have to send you the before and after photo of her after our call. But she arrived at our door with a police officer. And the look in her eyes, I mean, you wouldn't even have to do an assessment to know the significance of trauma. She was one of seven kids in living in abject poverty with her mom. Her mom could not feed them, so sent her at the age of two to go live with an uncle that lived right outside of Addis Ababa. He was great, and they had a great relationship. But by the time she hit about 8 years old, he was feeling bad that he could not get her to school because of how remote he was. So he contacted another family member and sent her to go live with them with the thought that she was going to be able to go to school. But instead of going to school, which we see this culturally in Ethiopia over and over again, she became the domestic servant of the home, where she was cleaning and just doing all the tasks of the home, but ended up being abused by the man in that home every single day, physically and sexually. She ended up running away to the streets after almost 2 years living in that household. And when the police found her and contacted the family, the aunt actually pressed charges against her and said that she was having an affair with her husband. And so she spent, Sebantu spent the next 30 days in the jail as they awaited for the judge to come down with a verdict on if she was guilty of adultery at 10 years old. So 30 days later, she was found not guilty. And that was the day she arrived at our doorstep. Okay. And I am telling you, Zach, like some of these, like when we looked at her, I mean, fearful, withdrawn, I mean, you look at kind of a trauma symptoms checklist, which we have. I mean, she checked every single box, years of abuse she suffered. And so she ended up spending the next 12 months in our care. And what that looks like is really valuing building that trusted relationship with her and day in and out. And it takes time for them to open up and start sharing their experiences. And in that home, I mean, we have daily Bible studies and something that we call nurture groups, where we're modeling for our kids, like how to give and receive care, because they don't even know how, because it hasn't been done for them. But slowly over that year period, we started to see this little girl like emerge again. And we started to see just her relationship with the Lord, like just really take root in her and just bring a joy back to her. That if you see that first photo to the photo that she took the day she left, we have a tree that we've painted on one of the walls. And when the girls leave that home, they get to take their hand and put it on the branch. And not only does that signify they were there, they're forever a part of our family, but it also is a reminder to the other girls in the home, it's not their final place. Like, we want to get them back into a path to family. And we ended up reunifying her with her original uncle after actually a few months of really in-depth work with the uncle because of the guilt he felt in sending her and what happened to her. But I am happy to tell you, like, today she's in school, she's living with that uncle, she's thriving. And after 12 months of like first assessment to leaving the home, she had a 98% decrease in her trauma symptoms. And that is the Lord, right? That is Jesus and the work that he did in her life. But, you know, we say it's not a easy process. It's not a short-term fix. It is showing up for these kids day in and day out when they push you away, when they don't want anything to do with you, when they are flipping their lids and they don't know how to regulate their emotions. being regulated adults that can show up and step in and bring calm and compassion and love in those scenarios, which that's the gospel. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what we're all called to do.
Well, man, to have the intervention of that judge who made it the right common sense decision on her life, was he, I think you said Addis Ababa was one of your hubs. Was that one of the places where you guys have had a chance to train and step into some of the government side of things and provide guidance and wisdom in that, on that side? And he was...
It's been huge. We've done a government training. So we've done that at a government level. And 18 months ago, we actually had the head of their national police invite our team in to do week training with the police officers. And you know, someone might say, well, you work with vulnerable children in child welfare systems. Why are you working with police? Well, the police are our first responders to our kids. Having them understand the viewpoint of that child at that moment that they're interacting and things, little things they can do to foster felt safety and connection in the in-between before they come into our care or someone else's care is huge. And we just, I can't even tell you the response we saw from the federal police officers that participated in this training. They actually put it on national news, the training, and they had interviews with some of these police officers. And one of my favorite quotes was this like Ethiopian police officer, so buttoned up, but I'll never forget, he made the quote of, this training allowed me to hear the heartbeat of a child. And I just thought, gosh, that's so powerful. When we can, as adults, you know, sometimes we talk about childhood resiliency and kids that are resilient. But at the end of the day, our kids should not have to be resilient. We as adults should be resilient. And we should do the deeper work to really allow the Holy Spirit to take shape in our lives and to our sin parts and to the parts that need healing by the Lord so that we then can be those safe, secure adults for kids. And so the work we're stepping into today, although it's child-centered, child-focused, I mean, we're standing up for this child now because there's urgency and these kids need us. We know they need safe, secure adults to be able to do that work. And that needs to be done at local levels. And so that's why empowering those local leaders with those tools is so, so important.
Yeah. What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys face around maybe the adoption side or some of the trauma-informed care stuff that you're doing? What are you running into consistently that's a barrier to what you're trying to do to help these kids?
I would say on adoption, which I know is always a really hard concept for anyone to really understand, but with all that red tape that the Hague did bring, the cost of adoption is astronomical. I mean, it's expensive. To adopt internationally is expensive, but what is hard to comprehend is that it doesn't even meet our budget. Like the fees that we receive in that process, I mean, it's always a red line. Every year in our budget, we're looking at red lines on adoption. And so it's always the challenge of like, how do we God's called us into unifying kids with families. It's a hard process to fund. So that's one. And then two, on the trauma side of the work, it's really the fact that we are working in ever-changing climates, right? Like, politics change every 4 years. Like we might have leaders that we always say it's the right person, the right place at the right time can make drastic change at like macro levels. But when those leaders leave, you know, that can fall off for a period of time and then you wait. And so that at times can be challenging because it's a constantly changing landscape of how we're having to move within the work we're doing. It's also, though, why it's so important we're doing it at a government level and local level, because what we have found is even when governments change, because it's so rooted locally, that usually stays the same. And then we weather some of those governmental ups and downs. Mm. But definitely that can be a challenge.
Yeah. What, on the financial side, that challenge, what is the some of the things that cause those high costs in the adoption process? Is it oftentimes corruption and on the government side, or is it something else altogether?
I mean, we only work in Hague countries. Okay. So the corruption today is not necessarily the issue. Some of the issues are on just cost. You have so many steps to the process for adoptive families. Now, granted, there are so many grant organizations out there that help families with that cost. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking at like the agency side of that work, you have to have a certain size team with certain credentials, and the agency fees that are charged for like what we would have historically had, let's say, on what we said would be a 2-year adoption mm-hmm. process. We're seeing those processes go 5 years, 6 years mm-hmm. as kids are changing, right? Like there's not kids available necessarily for adoption under 5 or 4 with mild needs. And so navigating that changing landscape elongates the time for families, which is really hard for adoptive mm-hmm. families, like super painful, but also the services that we're giving, like the piece of those fees that go to the agency, it's a hard budget yeah. item to do, because it's an unknown timeline. Like Haiti right now, with all of the conflict in Haiti, I mean, those adoptions are going 5 years. Like China hasn't reopened since COVID. Some of those families are going on 5-6 years and still waiting with no end in sight. So as the agency, you're still trying to service those families, but that's what can be mm. challenging.
Yeah. And then adoption policies and regulations, they can vary significantly by country, right? Is the Hague intervention causing or conference causing a movement towards consistent regulation across countries that are plugged into Hague, or is there not consistency across from country to country yet?
I mean, the Hague is consistent in the guidelines and regulations. You still do see differences from country to country and how they apply okay. it. So there are nuances in it. But then you also, yeah. So some countries might take a piece of that process and make it 9 months. And then on the flip side, you have our own country just to get an immigration approval. Mm-hmm. So you have to have an immigration approval to submit a dossier to a country to adopt. That used to be historically 20 years ago, that would take 2 months to get the U.S. immigration approval after a home study is approved. That's taking our own U.S. government now 10 Jeez. Months, 11 months. One piece of paper that says, yep, you have a home study, you're approved, you can adopt from this country. So if that's a year almost, it's another 6 months just to get all the paperwork together. Then it goes to the country. Then they have to review the paperwork before officially registering it. You could be 2 years in and the wait is just starting mm-hmm. as far as the documents being registered. It's a calling. Our families that are adopting, I mean, and I will tell you, Zach, it's some of the most beautiful, beautiful stories of just seeing God like unite this child with this family mm-hmm. and just the calling of the family to be in it, because they just know God has it. But it's a faith journey. It is such a faith yeah. journey. And it's everywhere. I mean, domestic too has that same component. It might not be as long, but definitely the same component.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So much of it.
But these kids need families. I will say that these kids need these families yeah. to stand up for them today, to step into the process. I will tell you the thing every year that is the most heartbreaking for me is to walk from orphanage to orphanage and see child after child, and what you read on paperwork and what you see in front of you is not the same. And these kids you know, you think, oh, seven is old. It's not old. They need the right families to step into that process and do the hard so that they can find a pathway home. So I will tell you, that's the prayer every single day of our team is for the Lord to bring us the families that will enter this process and stand up for these kids and be called and trust the Lord, because we need the families. These kids are there. Just making sure it's the families that meet the needs that they have.
Yeah.
And are prepared.
Well, one of the things that we've going through this process for us, we hear a lot is, man, in response to what we've experienced is, oh, that sounds so hard. I don't think I could ever deal with something like that or go through something like that or step into that kind of pain and suffering. But man, the kids on the other side are experiencing so much more suffering and so much more pain and challenge and strife and struggle that, like you said earlier, we should be willing to step into that need and bear that burden and bear that pain and suffering so that they don't have to. Like, yeah, it's hurtful and painful and it's an emotional roller coaster and it's a lot of hard going through this process. But if you approach it with the mindset that, man, this is probably so much worse for that child, if I can step into this and bear some of that burden on their behalf, like at the end of the day, it's the gospel modeled, but it's hard to hear those kind of reactions. It's like, yeah, but just think about the kid, like what they're experiencing, what they're going through. That's so much worse than any pain we're going to experience in dealing with impatience of the process, right? Like,
yeah.
So that's been one of the things that we've learned through this process, man, as hard as this been, yeah, I'm willing to make those steps into bearing that burden so that doesn't have to land as much on the child, because they're experiencing so much worse.
I love that, Zach, because it's so incredibly true. It's so incredibly true. And that is why having families that are prepared to meet those needs of kids and really have the understanding that even in the hardest of hard, because it's hard when you have children that are, you know, coming into your home with complex trauma, with unknowns, prenatal care, like all the things, but having the ability to understand that at all times, what is the need behind that behavior and how do I go deeper in bringing that connection to that child so that they can find healing and know that I'm a trusted, safe adult, because they've never had that in their life. It's the whole thing. Like, we do that. If we could do that as a humanity for ourselves, right, first ourselves, to do the work of healing for ourselves, because you have to do that to then be able to step in to do that for others. And so, I mean, that is the gospel. It's easy to say that. It's a lot harder to do it in action.
Yeah. It doesn't change the fact that it's hard.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
I don't think he calls us into an easy, comfortable life. I think there's lots of promises that it's going to be hard and it's going to be filled with suffering.
One of the things that I've learned
through this process for us is, I've grown up in the church. When we stepped into this process for us, part of my mindset and heart was just, this is my Christian obligation, like called to care for the orphan and widow. And that's just what we're called to do. And it's a command on all of our lives as disciples of Jesus. And as if you believe in the priesthood of all believers, like we're all called to these, to step into these needs. This is just my Christian obligation. And so I'm stepping into this need because that's what I'm supposed to do. And as we have stepped into this as a family, the most significant thing that I've learned, the theme that has come out consistently through this process, through all the emotional roller coaster and the patience that's been required and the dealing with the brokennesses of the system, is this is, yes, it's, I think you could argue that it's our Christian obligation, but at the end of the day, it's an invitation into deeper relationship with God. He's inviting us into a situation that's filled with struggle and challenge and strife and suffering and emotional hardship. But because he's inviting us into that, to do that with him, he's inviting us into something where we have to, I have to lean on him. Like, so much of this process is outside of our control. It has forced us to lean in on him and trust in him, because without him, we can't do any of this. Like, it's not going to work. And so to have to depend so much on him and to lean so much on him and to have to be required and forced into, almost forced into trusting him through this process, like, really at the end of the day, this invitation was an invitation into deeper relationship with him. And yes, it came with a lot of hard things, but our relationship with the Lord has grown significantly through the process, because, man, all of a sudden I'm outside of my comfort zone and I have no control in the situation. Yeah. And as a control freak, like, I like control. And so it just forces me into leaning on him. And so at the end of the day, this is not my Christian obligation, and that's what we're supposed to do because it's what we're called to do. It was an invitation. It was an invitation by God to go into something hard where I have to depend and trust in him. And so, not to say that I've handled every situation perfectly. Like, there's been lots of wrestling with the Lord and shape, like, why isn't this working out like we had hoped it would? But at the end of the day, I think that my mindset has shifted drastically through this process, from Christian obligation to, man, this is really an invitation into something deeper. So that's just
how God's working. Yeah. Right? Like, what work the Lord's doing mm-hmm. in you, because it's going to be that work that then you are able to pass on to future. But it starts with you. Yeah.
Well,
every word of that. Oh, right.
Thank you. Well, let's take another moment to hear from today's sponsor, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Holland Frazier of All God's Children International. Hey, church leaders. Today's episode is sponsored by Kingdom Stories. When it comes to your digital marketing and content strategies, have you ever wondered how you can use the power of storytelling and testimony? Imagine the impact. Stories and testimonies that resonate, that move hearts and minds. Testimonies that prepare people to receive gospel truths. Here's the problem. You're busy doing ministry and you don't have time to worry about your content strategies. And you definitely don't have time to worry about one more program. You already have way too much on your plate. The consequences? You're not taking full advantage of digital. The content you do post gets ignored. You have no plan or strategy for your digital engagement. And ultimately, God doesn't get the glory he deserves because we're not testifying of his transformational and redemptive work. What would it look like if your people knew how to share their testimonies? Your monthly content strategies were filled with stories instead of self-promotional content, and your content was focused on your people and God's work in their lives. What if your content was actually engaging because it was story-driven? Kingdom Stories is more than just a service. It's a catalyst for transformative digital communication. Stories change lives. Stories are engaging. And everyone has a story. What has happened in my life can happen in your life too. Here's the best part. You don't have to do any of the heavy lifting. Kingdom Stories will handle everything from start to finish. If you want to learn more or get our free content strategy map that will outline the entire process, go to kingdomstories.us. We know how overwhelming and frustrating content strategies and digital marketing can be. So we've solved that problem for you. Stop creating aimless content. Let us help you tell the stories coming out of your ministry. Let stories and testimonies fuel your church's digital outreach. All right, welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. We've been talking with Holland Frazier of All God's Children International. Holland, as we get back into the conversation, I want to circle back on some of the trauma-informed care stuff as it relates to storytelling and what you guys are seeing on the ground, what the implications are for storytelling within your trauma-informed care and within the disciple-making that you're doing. How is how is story, like, what are the implications of storytelling within those applications and contexts?
I'll tell you, like, and I, yes, culturally it's different in some ways, but I'll say when we're looking at how we empower local leaders, having the permission, I'll say permission, mm-hmm. to be vulnerable and actually share like the hard of what someone has experienced really brings a person onto a path mm-hmm. of healing. And you know, I think when you look at just how we as a society are raised to like not look back, especially as believers, right? Like the day you're saved, all perfect. It all goes away because the Holy and Spirit dwells. And the difference of that is then going, yes, that's true. But those hurts of a past are mm-hmm. real. And when we're able to verbalize them, the freedom that comes of telling our story is releasing all shame mm-hmm. or things that we thought we've either hidden in darkness or the worst parts about ourselves that we don't want to talk about. When you're able to have environments of community where there's not judgment and there's love, there's connection, there's relationship, there is that commitment of no matter what you do, I am showing mm-hmm. up for you every single day because I believe in you and the God that indwells mm-hmm. you and that you can overcome these things. You see incredible healing start to come and you see relationships grow mm-hmm. really deep. And, you know, even just thinking of a recent trip that I had with our team in Colombia, as we've launched this child advocacy center and we're growing our team right now pretty significantly. I want to say right now we're at like 30 staff and we're looking to grow that team to about 42. But I was there probably 4 months ago and taken aback at our team members on the ground. And, you know, one after another would come up to me and just tears in their eyes saying, working here has changed my life. I have never imagined that I would be able to get to show up and not only do this work, but have the support I need for who I am and who I want to be. Oh, wow. And so I will say the power of that storytelling and of people being able to know they're in, it's really felt safety, like they're in a safe place and that they are going to be loved unconditionally and be able to release those experiences and also have others that can actually connect the dots on what the threads are through their yesterday to mm-hmm. today is super powerful. And it's different among cultures, but also the same in how powerful mm-hmm. it is.
So yeah, what are you guys are seeing so much trauma and serving, especially children who have experienced so much trauma. What are some of the things that you're learning from the storytelling process within these small faith communities that as a practitioner of Karen Purvis Institute, being able to apply the things that you've learned, but really be a resource that's getting to be on the front line of significant trauma over and over and over again, probably unlike most organizations and other organizations that are a part of the Karen Purvis Institute or similar models, if they exist, like what are the things that you're learning in those small faith community, in small group community where storytelling just becomes more and more significant? Like I'm really interested in learning about the things that you guys are seeing and learning and the adjustments that you're making or the changes that you're making to how you're using storytelling. What kind of insights can you share with us on that?
I would say on that, when we're looking at how our team, like if I spoke from a uh-huh. team side, we're going into hard places and we're working with caregivers, children, leaders, and it's a lot of hard things. And that storytelling is a part of that process. But what I would say as a leader, and as we're empowering that team, we have to be caring for each other in that. And we have to be living out that storytelling within mm-hmm. ourselves in order to then go out and be with others.
Modeling.
So it's a model. It has to be modeled, because it's only through the modeling of it that it does it become mm-hmm. authentic and part of the nature of just how we do the work. But you can't do the work if you don't have people, you know, feeding into you in that same process. And so that is a really, I would say, it's a learning and an important piece that, yes, you can say, well, I know all this information, I'm this practitioner, and I can go and tell my story, do this storytelling piece. But if I'm not also doing the work that I need to be doing to stay where I need to be and have others supporting me in that, it doesn't work. So I guess one learning I would say, it's an ongoing process. It has to be ongoing, and it has to be truthful, and you have to be vulnerable.
Okay.
To have that authenticity of it.
We had a couple recent guests on the show have talked about this idea of storytelling within exploring our past and exploring like what causes us to relate to God the way that we do. We just had a leader, VP of Cadence International, their military. So they're seeing real trauma, like war-torn areas of the world, front lines of Ukraine right now. They're dealing with real life, real war-torn experience and trauma. And so we talked about this with him. And then previously we had Brian Fisher on the show, who runs a ministry called Soil and Roots. They have a podcast of the same name, Soil and Roots podcast. And they talk a lot about the broken relationships at the fall, where us and God, our relationship with us and others, our relationship with us and creation, and what is often ignored within the Christian church, I think, especially in the West, is the broken relationship between us and ourselves. And that idea, I think there's a lot of faux pas within the Christian church about what it looks like to redeem the relationship between us and ourselves, because, man, we have a flesh and it's broken, and its tendency is to always be bent towards and run towards sin. And so we just need to off with the self and be filled with the Holy Spirit. And that is an absolutely true and biblically right statement. But there is healing that needs to take place within that relationship. And so Brian talks a lot about that on his show, and we discuss that on the podcast. So what you guys are seeing and what you guys are applying within the storytelling space of the willingness for me to go back in my story and share my story with others and process some of the things that might have happened, even in a safe and up and loving upbringing like I had, a secure environment that I grew up in. Like, there's still moments in my childhood and moments in my relationships with friends and family and community and parents that affect how I relate to God now, and going back and exploring those things so that I can better understand how I relate to God and why do I consistently struggle with whether or not he actually loves me, and whether or not he loves me regardless of what I do, and whether or not he loves me regardless of how disciplined I am, or all the things that I've set up for myself, to these to-do lists to check off my list as things that make him love me. Like, my behaviors tend towards the more things I do, the more he's going to love me. Why is that? Like, why is that my tendency? Well, if I can explore my past and explore some of those things that might have happened in my childhood or in past experiences, that helps me fully or more fully understand why I relate to God in that way and why I continually struggle with not being able to receive his grace as well as I'd like to, you know? And so, like, that's coming from a secure upbringing. Like, what you guys are seeing with your trauma situation, The trauma-informed care and the circumstances and experiences and stories that are coming out of the children of that you serve, like, man, I think that there's this profound things that we can learn from you guys.
Yeah. And we have a university home in Columbia. Okay. It's 24 women ages 18 to 24. Mm-hmm. So they have grown up in the child welfare system. They were never adopted. They could never be reunified with their families. And they come into our home at 18 and they go to school and they're there and we're supporting them. And it's to the point, Zach, like it's so layered on those histories, those stories. Mm-hmm. And it's not a fast process mm-hmm. of getting to the story. I mean, there are years and years of building relationship and mm-hmm. trust to actually even start to chip away at those experiences and how that thread from childhood, their experiences, all the traumas throughout the system to then the healing mm-hmm. that then can take them into their future. And I mean, when you think how hard that is, even for us who grew up, like you said, in like a secure home and, you know, yes, certain things, but then you look at the kids we're serving, it's like,
yeah,
it's another whole level to that.
Yeah. No family wanted me. No parents wanted me. How could I believe that there's a God that actually wants relationship with me?
And sometimes, you know, people ask, well, do you make all the girls in that home in Columbia, do they have to go to church every Sunday? It's like, no, they don't. Like, what we want to do is connect with them to build trusting relationships with our team through relationship that loves Jesus. But we want that journey for each of them to be their authentic journey to the Lord if they don't have it already. Like, and so it's not about like a set rules of what they have to do or not do. It's meeting each of them in the pain of where they're at. If they're, and let's be clear, at the beginning, they won't even let us into their pain. They're doing the things that they've done to even get to be 18 or 22 and entering the home, which sometimes can be a lot of really unhealthy behaviors of manipulation and lying and cheating, like to make their way. But you understand the why. And so it is very complex to get. It's not quick. I mean, we're talking years. We're not talking months. We're talking it's a process mm-hmm. of years. And that's where I love the work that we're doing, because we're not saying we're going into the easy or the quick mm-hmm. fix. We're going into the deep and the hard and the long term. And it could be 10 years before we even see one of those young women be able to relate their story all the way through. I mean, it could take mm-hmm. a decade. But we're committed to mm-hmm. it and the importance of it, because it is those threads for us all the way through that we have to be able to go back and understand why we do some of the things we do or the relationships we choose to be in or all of those things. It all stems, good or bad, childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, Holland, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your insights. If people want to get a hold of you and learn more about what you guys are doing, how do they do so?
Well, they could go to our website, which is www.allgodschildren.org, or they could email me personally at hfrazier@allgodschildren.org. Awesome.
Can I pray for you as we wrap up?
I would love it, Zach. Thank you.
Father, I just thank you so much for Holland and her willingness to come on the show and just share what you're doing through this amazing ministry. I pray that you would continue to guide and lead and direct and provide wisdom and clarity for Holland and her team and where to take the organization next and what, where and how you might be moving through this ministry. Thank you for the work that they're doing to come alongside children and care for them in really hard and difficult situations, Father. I pray that you would just give strength to their team to be able to endure and walk with patience through some of these stories. I know that has to put a and place a toll on their on their lives and their emotions. And so I just lift their team up to you and pray for strength and peace and encouragement, Lord. And I just ask that you would continue to lead Holland as she leads this organization, that you would strengthen her and give her peace and comfort and guidance along the way, Lord. We love you. And thank you that we get to be a part of what you're doing. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Holland, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Zach. I really appreciate you inviting me on.
Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ministry Grow Show. If you enjoyed it, we'd appreciate it if you rate and or review us on the iTunes store. And make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you have a story to share with other ministry directors and pastors, or know someone who would be an incredible guest on the Ministry Grow Show, let us know. We love connecting with ministry executives and sharing their wisdom and insight with our audience. Just send us an email at info@reliantcreative.org. And lastly, if you need help telling your ministry story, we would love to share how we can help in that process. Check out Reliant Creative at reliantcreative.org. See you next time.